Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Okay, let's start right up with the public health news and research roundup, where I gather up all the wonderful things in the world of public health so you don't have to.
Attention listeners, as per the WAKT Pro Bono Legal Department, please note that this public health news and research roundup has no affiliation with the herbicide Roundup, which is a registered trademark of Monsanto. Also, please note that, unlike the herbicide Roundup, this public health news and research roundup is not a known human carcinogen.
First up from ProPublica, we found over 700 doctors who were paid more than $1 million by drug and medical device companies. Back in 2013, ProPublica detailed what seemed a stunning development in the pharmaceutical industry's drive to win the prescription pads of the nation's doctors. In just 4 years, one doctor had earned $1 million giving promotional talks and consulting for drug companies. 21 others had made more than $500,000. 6 years later, despite often damning scrutiny from prosecutors and academics, such high earnings had become commonplace. More than 2,500 physicians have received at least $500,000 apiece from drug makers and medical device companies in the past 5 years alone, a new ProPublica analysis of payment data shows. And that doesn't include money for research or royalties from inventions. More than 700 of these doctors received at least $1 million. Holy smoke, said Dr. Waylid Gilead, an associate professor of medicine and health policy at the University of Pittsburgh. It is quite striking how much money doctors are earning from other activities outside from patient care, he said. Some academics and physicians predicted that the exposure might cause companies to rethink making payments and doctors to rethink taking them. A flurry of studies matched the payment data with doctors' prescribing choices and found links between the payments and the products doctors chose. But ProPublica's new analysis shows that the public reporting has not dampened the enthusiasm of the drug and medical device industry for having doctors deliver paid dinner talks and sponsored speeches or paying them to consult on products. In fact, there's been almost no change in how the industry is spending. Each year from 2014 to 2018, drug and medical device companies spent between $2.1 billion, that's with a B, and $2.2 billion paying doctors for speaking and consulting, as well as on meals, travels, and gifts for them. These figures do not include research spending, but they do include royalties. Over the course of 5 years, 1 million doctors, dentists, optometrists, chiropractors, and podiatrists received at least one payment, most often a meal from a company. Of those practitioners, more than 323,000 received at least one payment every year. For context, there are about 1.1 million doctors in the United States. Dr. Aaron Mitchell, a medical oncologist and health services researcher at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, said his research has shown that when doctors interact more consistently with a drug company, they are more likely to prescribe that company's cancer drug. The drug industry, Mitchell said, knows that they need to cultivate relationships over more time, so that's what they're trying to do. It's not just one drug meal, it's consistency. Promotional spending is a major way that manufacturers in these situations distinguish themselves from one another, not by conducting comparative studies or by engaging in substantial price reductions. ProPublica and a number of researchers have examined the type of drugs that prompt the highest payments. Ross of Yale and a colleague published an analysis in the British Medical Journal in 2017 that found that the top promoted drugs were less likely than tops less likely than top-selling and top-prescribed drugs to be effective, safe, affordable, novel, and represent a genuine advance in treating a disease. Our findings suggest that pharmaceutical promotion should be met with a healthy skepticism, the analysis concludes. And if you want to check on your own doctor's payments by pharmaceutical companies, you can search for Dollars for Docs and look up your own doc and find out precisely what payments were made from this ProPublica database. Okay, next up in a related story, we're going to do a whole string of them here, folks, from Stat News. The cancer growing in cancer medicine. Pharma money paid to doctors. Americans are rightly furious about the high and unsustainable price of cancer drugs, which now routinely cost more than $100,000 per year of therapy. These prices are made worse by the fact that most cancer drugs offer only modest benefits. One study put the median benefit at 2.1 extra months of life, along with the fact that expert physicians frequently recommend these drugs for off-label uses, meaning using a drug for a purpose it was not initially approved for. The House of Representatives, the Senate, presidential candidates, and even the president have floated proposals to tackle drug prices. While all contain good ideas, none address one of the elephants in the room, the experts who tell doctors how to use these medications. Expert physicians play an oversized role in cancer medicine. They write the editorials in major medical journals that can influence physicians' prescribing practices. They give educational sessions at national meetings, and they decide what evidence is good enough for off-label use. Spoiler alert, the evidence is often weak. All of this might be fine if experts offered neutral or unbiased information, but evidence suggests they do not. One study found that 85% of the experts who wrote widely used cancer guidelines had received payments averaging more than $10,000 from pharmaceutical companies. These guidelines mandate that Medicare pay for off-label use of cancer drugs. Research also showed that physicians who consistently put pharmaceutical money in their bank accounts are more likely to prescribe that company's drugs. Financial conflict of interest in cancer medicine matters. The pharmaceutical industry is run by intelligent people who choose to pay physicians millions of dollars. It is hard to believe that they have not calculated that this aids their bottom lines. Within the profession, there is little interest in reform. Our rules, our suggestions, our punishments lack teeth. Last year, Dr. Jose Baselga, the physician-in-chief at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, was found to have violated the disclosure policies of several medical journals across dozens of publications. Baselga resigned from his position, but his, quote, punishment lasted only 116 days before he was named executive vice president of AstraZeneca, a prominent and coveted industry position. The fundamental problem is that, as a profession, cancer physicians are not interested in addressing conflict of interest. Too many people in prominent positions benefit from the current lax policies. Disclosure is not the solution. Ending these payments is. I want to be clear. I'm all for doctors interacting with and working with the pharmaceutical and device industries. I have lectured at major pharmaceutical companies, but without accepting money, travel expenses, or meals. Researchers should be free to work with pharmaceutical companies on trials, but there is no legitimate reason why well-paid physicians need to take personal payments, gifts, meals, or travel expenses from the pharmaceutical industry. That practice must end. Conflict of interest is the cancer growing in cancer medicine. It poisons the field. It leads us to celebrate marginal drugs as if they were game changers. It leads experts to ignore or downplay flaws and deficits in cancer clinical trials. It keeps doctors silent about the crushing price of cancer medicines. It is rampant in guidelines that lead to off-label prescribing and that mandate payment. It is surely a calculated maneuver by the industry to increase their profits. The Sunshine Clause of the Affordable Care Act, which requires listing industry payments to physicians on the Open Payments website, was a reform passed by Congress. It did not emerge through self-regulation by doctors. Ending payments from the industry to physicians is also unlikely to come from self-regulation. We need the people of America, through political processes, to cure us of this cancer. Okay, and continuing in a similar vein, from USA Today, massive marketing muscle pushes 3D mammograms despite no evidence they save more lives, investigation shows. When Dr. Warda McCaskill-Stevens made an appointment for a mammogram last year, she expected a simple breast cancer screening, not a heavy-handed sales pitch. A receptionist asked if she wanted a free upgrade to a 3D mammogram or tomosynthesis. She said, "There's a new approach and it's much better and it finds all cancer," said McCaskill Stevens, who declined the offer. A short time later, a technician asked again, was the patient sure she didn't want 3D? Upselling customers on high-tech breast cancer screenings is just one way the 3D mammography industry aggressively promotes its products. A Kaiser Health News investigation found that manufacturers, hospitals, doctors, and some patient advocates have put their marketing muscle and millions of dollars behind 3D mammograms. The juggernaut has left many women feeling pressured to undergo screenings, which, according to the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, haven't been shown to be more effective than traditional mammograms. "There's a lot of money to be made," said Dr. Stephen Woloshin, director of the Center for Medicine and Media at the Dartmouth Institute for Health Policy and Clinical Practice, who published a study in January showing that the healthcare industry spent $30 billion a year on marketing. Kaiser Health News investigation shows that industry money has shaped policy, public opinion, and patient care around 3D. Taxpayers write the check for many 3D screenings, which add about $50 to the cost of a typical mammogram. Medicare, which began paying for 3D exams in 2015, spent an additional $230 million on breast cancer screenings within the first 3 years of coverage. By 2017, nearly half the mammograms paid for by the federal government were 3D. On average, 3D screenings may slightly increase cancer detection rates, finding about one extra breast cancer tumor for every 1,000 U.S. women screened, according to a 2018 analysis in the Journal of the National Cancer Institute. Yet newer tech isn't necessarily better, and it can cause harm, said Dr. Otis Brawley, a professor at Johns Hopkins University. "It's unethical to push a product before you know it helps people." The American Cancer Society, Susan G. Komen, and the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force also say there isn't yet enough evidence to advise women on 3D mammograms. Diagnosing more cancers doesn't necessarily help women. That's because not all breast tumors are life-threatening. Some grow so slowly that women would live just as long as they ignored them or never even know they were there. Finding these tumors often leads women to undergo treatments they don't need. A 2017 study estimated 1 in 3 women with breast cancer detected by a mammogram are treated unnecessarily. It's possible 3D mammograms make that problem worse by finding even more small, slow-growing breast tumors than 2D, said Dr. Alex Crist, vice chairman of the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, an expert panel that issues health advice. "By steering women towards 3D mammograms before all the evidence is in, we could potentially hurt women." Some experts worry that patients who tend to overestimate their risk of dying from breast cancer are acting out of fear when they choose treatment. If there was ever an audience susceptible to direct-to-consumer advertising, it's women afraid of breast cancer. Some proponents of 3D mammograms imply that women who opt for 2D are taking a risk. While screenings may not generate a lot of income, they can attract patients who need other, more profitable hospital procedures. "Anytime you diagnose more tumors, you can treat more tumors," said Amitabh Chandra, Director of Health Policy Research at Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Government. There you go. Isn't proven to work more, costs a lot more. Woo, let's do that. Okay, sticking with the pharmaceutical company theme, this from Reuters. Teva's proposed opioid settlement could cost drug makers pennies on the dollar. Teva Pharmaceutical Industry Limited's proposed $23 billion drug giveaway to settle thousands of U.S. opioid lawsuits will likely cost the company a fraction of that figure due to how it has valued those medicines, according to a Reuters review of pricing data and industry analysts. When Teva announced the value of the donated medicine, a generic version of opioid addiction treatment Suboxone, it based the figure on the drug's list price, which does not account for significant discounts routinely provided by the drug maker. If based on the estimated cost to manufacture the drug, the value could be as low as $1.5 billion, drug pricing consultants and industry analysis say. Okay, so $1.5 billion compared to the list price advertised to the public, $23 billion. Yeah, seems disingenuous to me. Okay, back to ProPublica again. Quick update. We found a staggering 281 lobbyists who've worked in the Trump administration. With a combination of weakened rules and loose enforcement easing the transition to government and back to K Street, Trump's swamp is anything but drained. The number of lobbyists who have served in government jobs is four times more than the Obama administration had 6 years into office. And former lobbyists serving Trump are often involved in regulating the industries they worked for. Okay. Talking more about medical waste, this from CBS News. Wasted healthcare spending in the U.S. tops annual defense budget study finds. Waste in the U.S. healthcare system ranges from $760 billion to $935 billion per year, or more than total annual federal defense spending, according to a new study. Administrative activities account for the largest source of needless spending, followed by inflated and opaque pricing. The prices of healthcare don't reflect what would happen in a competitive market. This is an interesting example of how for-profit does not work. In fact, the so-called free market causes these distortions, doesn't solve these problems. Okay, back to the story. There are so many different payers, kinds of coding, billing products, record-keeping requirements, that you get a system that when you get a system that complicated, it adds tasks and paperwork. Indeed, a 2016 study funded by the American Medical Association found that doctors spent almost twice as much time on administrative work, 49% of their time, as they did seeing patients, 27%. Physicians also took another 1 or 2 hours of clerical work home with them each night. The existing fee-for-service payment system, under which each provider bills for the services they deliver, is another major source of complexity and waste. Right now, you're billed for the hospital room, by the ambulance company, by every doctor, rehab facility. Everyone is keeping their own records and doing their own billing and dividing it up into tiny pieces, which makes it hard for the patient and hard for the caregivers. It has long since outlasted its usefulness. Okay, let's switch gears from a lot of bad news to some good news. Okay, this from the New York Times. To treat chronic ailments, fix diet first. Last year, California's version of Medicaid, Medi-Cal, introduced a 3-year pilot study that's already showing what experts in the healthcare field have seen anecdotally, that tailored nutrition can improve health and lower medical costs for chronically ill patients. The pilot includes specially formulated meals and in-home visits for congestive heart failure patients, which has caused some of the highest rates of hospital readmissions. Project Angel Food, one of 6 California nonprofits participating in the pilot, delivers such meals. In addition to providing lunch and dinner and a nutritional guide for every meal, nutritionists show clients how to portion their meals and, when they're ready to transition off the program, how to shop for food and cook for themselves. Most of the restrictions eliminate saturated fats and emphasize whole grains, in addition to limiting sodium and fluids. In congestive heart failure particularly, the body can no longer maintain an appropriate balance between sodium and water. For lower-income patients who may often rely on canned or prepared foods, this can feel overwhelming, especially if they don't have the means to start shopping for healthy fresh food and cooking it from scratch. Medi-Cal patients were chosen for the pilot because in general they frequently use the healthcare system. Data from 2017 shows that of California's Medicaid patients with congestive heart failure who had discharged from the hospital, a third returned in less than a month. Published estimates of average hospital stays for those with the condition range between 5 to 6 days, with cost estimates between $10,000 to $15,000 per stay. But self-reported statistics show a mere 6.2% readmission rate after 30 days for the 404 participants enrolled in the Medi-Cal pilot. Another body of research, however, is showing that medically tailored meals can go a long way toward reversing that downward health spiral. A retrospective cohort study headed by Seth Berkowitz, MD, at the University of North Carolina Chapel Hill School of Medicine and published recently concluded, participation in a medically tailored meals program appears to be associated with fewer hospital and skilled nursing admissions and less overall medical spending. Maximal compliance with drug therapy doesn't keep congestive heart failure patients out of the hospital without dietary adherence, Dr. Hussein said. So providing medically tailored meals is a potentially easy win all around. Sick or elderly patients can stay home and remain independent, while reduced hospital admission dramatically reduces healthcare costs and overall burden in the system. Okay, one step, integrating nutrition better into the interface with medicine. Of course, we can do it even farther back in the road with more primary prevention, people just eating well in general before they get deathly ill. Okay, another advantage of eating well, this from Science Daily, nutritious foods have lower environmental impact than unhealthy foods. Widespread adaptation to healthier diets would markedly reduce the environmental impact of agriculture and food production, according to new research from the University of Minnesota and Oxford University. For the first time, researchers have tied the health impacts of foods to their overall environmental impact. The report in the journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences concludes that foods with positive health outcomes have among the lowest environmental impacts, while other foods, such as red meat, can be especially harmful to both. The foods making up our diets have a large impact on both ourselves and our environment. This study shows that eating healthier also means eating more sustainably, said Dr. Tillman, professor of ecology, evolution, and behavior at the University of Minnesota College of Biological Sciences. Normally, if a food product is good for one aspect of a person's health, it's better for other health outcomes as well. The same holds for environmental outcomes. The researchers explored how consuming 15 different food groups is, on average, associated with 5 different health outcomes and 5 aspects of environmental degradation. The results show that almost all foods associated with improved health outcomes, such as whole grain cereals, fruits, vegetables, legumes, nuts, and olive oil, have the lowest environmental impacts. Likewise, foods with the largest increases in disease risk, primarily unprocessed and processed red meat, are consistently associated with the largest negative environmental impacts. Researchers concluded that transitioning diets toward greater consumption of healthier foods would also improve environmental sustainability. The study underscores recent recommendations from the United Nations and others about the environmental impacts of human diets. An August report from the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change recommended individuals eat more plant-based foods as a way to adapt to and limit worsening climate change. This study shows that replacing red meat with more nutritious options can greatly improve health and the environment. It's important that we all think about how the health impacts of the foods we eat. We now know that making our nutrition a priority will pay dividends for the earth as well. Okay, next up from Science Daily, study found focusing on patients' values instead of problems offered better results. Patients with complex needs, serious mental and physical health problems, and substance use disorders flock to emergency rooms, costing the healthcare system billions every year. A new study suggests a non-traditional approach to these patients can significantly improve their daily functioning and health outcomes. In crisis and with nowhere to turn, thousands of patients with complex needs every year flock to emergency rooms in Harris County, Texas, and across the country. Referred to as high need, high cost, these patients have limited ability to take care of themselves, making it challenging for doctors to find effective treatments. Their health problems are mostly left unresolved, and they consistently return to the ERs, costing the health system billions every year. The ERs are not designed to address chronic medical or acute social problems such as homelessness, hunger, and job loss. New research suggests a non-traditional approach to these patients can significantly improve their daily functioning and health outcomes. Complicating matters, patients with a number of different diagnoses typically visit multiple medical and social service agencies, hospital systems, health clinics, food pantries, shelters, with no collective record available to each organization. This can lead to both gaps and overlapping services, resulting in higher costs and insufficient care. The diagnostic-based approach, telling patients what's wrong and here's how to fix it before sending them on their way, coupled with a lack of information about where they've been, has worked spectacularly badly for underserved populations who already have reason not to trust us, said Dr. David Buck, Associate Dean for Community Health at the University of Houston College of Medicine. We need to find a better way to not only lower healthcare costs, but more importantly, improve their quality of life. In a study published in the journal Population Health Management, Buck and his research team reported a novel intervention that integrates a psychological, values-based approach with coordinated care management significantly helped improve daily functioning, including money management, personal hygiene, social connectivity, and relationships for this vulnerable group of patients. The values-based approach to care was applied to 18 high-need, high-cost patients at the Patient Care Intervention Center in Houston, a nonprofit organization founded by Buck. Over the course of 6 months, care coordinators worked with the patients to identify their values and associated goals as a way to start meaningful discussions and ultimately engage them in appropriate care. Buck calls it a way of centering providers on who or what is most important to the patient through a cognitive behavioral therapy informed approach. Instead of focusing on their problems, we focus on their values and goals. Instead of the push and pull of doctors telling patients not to do something for the sake of their health, we look at who and what is most important to the client. It's trust building and a way to reach the root of the problem. The nonprofit also integrates millions of service utilization records from medical and social service agencies through its comprehensive health record system called the Unified Care Continuum Platform. By linking data from patient visits, the researchers wrote, communication gaps between agencies that often work independently are bridged to provide a complete view of utilization and needs, as well as identify common clients and service gaps in the community. This helps to overcome systemic barriers to health that might exist and reduce duplication of services. Buck recalls a patient with HIV and bipolar disorder who showed up in emergency rooms every few days. The patient racked up more than $1 million in bills. No one was successful in engaging him. He hated the ERs, but he was in crisis, said Buck, who discovered that the patient's dog was his main motivation. The patient left his dog tied up and alone for days whenever he went to the hospital. Instead of just demanding he get on his meds, we discussed what was not working for him. Instead of getting in the medical zone, we would go back to the dog. He didn't like leaving his best friend behind. We would ask what was getting in the way of his value to be good to his dog. He identified his need to get primary care for his chronic illnesses rather than acute crisis care. This approach gives people the power to decide how they need to behave instead of being told. The patient now regularly visits a primary care clinic, avoiding the emergency room. Buck said if the intervention could positively impact even the most challenging patients, it has implications for improving health care for everyone. Okay. Another story from Science Daily. In the long run, drugs and talk therapy hold same value for people with depression. Spending an hour in talk therapy with a trained counselor costs much more and takes more time than swallowing an inexpensive antidepressant pill. But for people with a new diagnosis of major depression, the costs and benefits of the two approaches end up being equal after 5 years, a new study shows. The analysis conducted using real-world data on treatment costs, positive and negative health effects, and impacts of treatment and depression symptoms on productivity could help guide future care and insurance coverage. The study suggests that more people newly diagnosed with depression should have a chance to try individual and group sessions of cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT, as their first treatment, if they would prefer therapy over taking an antidepressant medication. A team of research from the University of Michigan and Harvard University published the findings in this week's issues of Annals of Internal Medicine. National physician groups such as the American College of Physicians endorse giving people newly diagnosed with depression the option to choose either approach, but this would mean expanding the capacity of the healthcare system to provide greater access to psychotherapy than is currently available. However, making CBT more available could save money for the companies and government agencies that pay for depression care, including by giving patients more depression-free time, leading to improved performance at work. One might assume that antidepressants are more cost-effective than psychotherapy because they don't require travel time, time away from work, and as many contacts with providers as therapy does, says first author Dr. Eric Ross, a psychiatrist at Harvard Medical School. But when incorporating the long-term effectiveness of each treatment, we found that neither treatment is consistently superior to the other. Since CBT and antidepressants are roughly equivalent from a health economic perspective, other factors should determine what treatment an individual patient receives, and the most important factor is the patient's values and preferences, says Kara Zivin, PhD, senior author of the new study and professor of psychiatry at the University of Michigan Medical School. Zivin is also a member of the VA Center for Clinical Management Research. In the end, though, the shortage of trained medical providers may do more to govern what kind of treatment patients receive. The demand for mental health treatment exceeds the current and projected numbers of clinicians specializing in psychiatry and related mental health professions. Research indicates that the majority of people with depression would prefer to receive therapy instead of medications, but only 25% of them actually receive therapy. The Veterans Health Administration, though, has succeeded in increasing the percentage of veterans receiving cognitive behavioral therapy in recent years. Often we think about these calculations in the short term, because insurance coverage is year to year. But if we see effects like these in under 5 years, perhaps our society will be more willing to bear the upfront costs in order to avoid the indirect costs of missed work and underproductivity later on. Okay, next up from Science Daily, mentally ill die many years earlier than others. Based on registered data from 7.4 million persons living in Denmark between 1995 and 2015, the new nationwide study from the National Center for Register-Based Research at Aarhus University is the most comprehensive study ever done on mortality in persons with mental disorders. The risk of an early death was higher for people with mental disorders across all ages. When looking at differences in life expectancy, the researchers found that men and women with mental disorders on average had life expectancies respectively 10 and 7 years shorter after the diagnosis of the disease compared to an overall Danish person of the same age. I would note that in the U.S., since we have a more disarrayed healthcare system and mental health system, that might perhaps be worse in the U.S. Okay, next up, also from Science Daily, new study points to another possible correlation between sleep and overall good health. As if you didn't already have enough to worry about to keep you up at night, a new study indicates that poor sleep can negatively affect your gut microbiome, which in turn can lead to additional health issues. That's at the heart, or gut, of the study just published in PLOS One that involves several researchers from Nova Southeastern University. They wanted to see just how much of a connection there is going on in our insides and how that may impact the quality of sleep we experience. Given the strong gut-brain bidirectional communication, they likely influence each other, said Jamie Tarter, PhD, a professor and the research director. Based on previous reports, we think that poor sleep probably exerts a strong negative effect on gut health microbiome diversity. What you may be asking yourself right now is, what in the world is the gut microbiome? Simply put, it's all the microorganisms, bacteria, viruses, protozoa, and fungi, and their genetic material found in your gastrointestinal or GI tract. And yes, we all have these in our GI tract, but not all at the same levels of diversity. As it turns out, it's this diversity that could be the key. For this study, subjects wore what Tarter called an Apple Watch on steroids to bed, which monitored all sorts of vitals. This way, the researchers could determine just how well a night's sleep the subjects got. And when they tested the subjects' gut microbiome, what they found was those who slept well had a more diverse or better gut microbiome. Tarter said that gut microbiome diversity, or lack thereof, is associated with other health issues, such as Parkinson's disease and autoimmune diseases, as well as psychological health, such as anxiety and depression. The more diverse someone's gut microbiome is, the likelihood is that they will have better overall health. We know that sleep is pretty much the Swiss Army knife of health, Tarter said. Getting a good night's sleep can lead to improved health, and a lack of sleep can have detrimental effects. We've all seen the reports that show not getting proper sleep can lead to short-term stress, psychosocial issues, and long-term cardiovascular disease, cancer, health problems. We know that the deepest stages of sleep is when the brain takes out the trash, since the brain and gut communicate with each other. Quality sleep impacts so many other facets of human health. And just as a note on that, the gut is considered the second brain, in that outside of the skull, most of your nervous system is in your gastrointestinal tract. So no surprise that they are connected. Okay, quick story to end the show on racial inequalities. This from the American Heart Association. Racial inequities uncovered in hospital admissions for heart failure. Black and Latino patients with heart failure are less likely to be treated in cardiac units when admitted to the hospital. Heart failure patients not treated in a specialized cardiac care unit are more likely to be readmitted within 1 month of discharge. People who are Black or of Latin American descent with heart failure are less likely to be admitted to specialized cardiology units, a disparity that may help explain long-known racial differences in heart failure outcomes, according to a new research published in the American Heart Association journal, Circulation, Heart Failure. Racial inequities and higher readmission rates among minority populations have been documented in previous studies. However, this study's findings suggest that admissions practices may provide a partial explanation behind these well-known racial disparities in heart failure outcomes. The researchers emphasized that the observed disparities in outcomes likely stem from structural and systemic differences in care rather than biological differences in disease progression for people with different ancestries. The factors behind the differences in admission patterns are likely multifactorial, the researchers said, but reflect inequities in outpatient access to outpatient cardiology care. Black and Latinx patients are not under the care were not under the care of a cardiologist as an outpatient at the time of hospitalization, the strongest predictor of admission to a cardiology unit, according to the study. Levels of perceived discrimination and mistrust in the healthcare system may also lead to differential self-advocacy for admission to a specialized service by patients from different backgrounds. While structural drivers are likely the major drivers, the authors feel that implicit bias is ubiquitous and probably contributes as well. Okay, well, that does it for our show today. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email me at wakt@toppun.com. If you want to review this show, listen to any previous show, or queue up future shows, you can go to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible, but in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.